the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness on today, Thursday, March 29th, 2007. And I'd like to open, what am I looking
at? HDR.
The, it's a work session, right? Work session on HDR 51.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to summarize, HDR 51, that's a House joint resolution. This is a measure that would recognize the contributions made to communities by persons with developmental disabilities. It would also recommend using savings in the governor's proposed budget to provide services for persons with developmental disabilities. Chair, there also is a Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 1 amendment essentially has two components. One would add language stating that the proposed closure of the Eastern Oregon Training Center would have a significant impact upon the city of Pendleton. That would be new language. And the second piece of the amendment would add language that any closure of Eastern Oregon Training Center be coupled with an economic development plan for the city of Pendleton, including the study for alternative uses of the Eastern Oregon Training Center.
Thank you, Andy. Representative Gelfair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We discussed this a couple of weeks ago, and there were some concerns, so I went back and had these amendments drafted after talking to some other members of our body who have some particular concerns about the institution that was named in this joint resolution. The other thing that's changed since we last met is that the governor has rescinded his recommendation that Eastern Oregon Training Center close. However, it's still an issue in the co-chair's proposed budget because that announcement was not made until after the co-chair's presentation on the budget. And therefore, I would argue that this resolution is still very appropriate. It talks specifically about Eastern Oregon Training Center as an example, as well as rule changes related to nursing homes, and that the intent of the resolution is to say that in our human service system, when we find savings for programs for people with developmental disabilities and find ways to do them less expensively by providing community-based supports, those monies should stay in the developmental disability system rather than going out to other parts of the budget. The amendments to the resolution are just as Andy said, and I did check, you'll note on line one of the dash ones, there is the word abilities in quotes, and that is intentional because on line 17, the word disabilities was hyphenated. So that's not a mistake in the dash ones if you're concerned. I have discussed this language with particular colleagues in the House that are not on this committee that have particular concern with Eastern Oregon Training Center, who indicated that while anything with the words equal Eastern Oregon Training Center causes heartburn, that this relieved that to a certain degree because it does recognize that the people that serve individuals with disabilities, their futures are very tied up with the individuals that they serve. So I would ask that you join me in supporting this resolution, that we send it to the floor, that we make a statement that as we move forward and find savings in systems, that we keep them focused on vulnerable people that need those services.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions of Representative Gelfair?
Comment.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, I appreciate what you did on this. I was not aware of the governor's rescinding of that, but I'm one of the folks that was talking to Representative Gelser, and I just appreciate not only your commitment, which we've all seen, but now your sensitivity, so I will be voting aye.
Any other questions or comments?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I just want to make a comment about Eastern Oregon Training Center, and I know there's a lot of questions about its long-term viability, but I think the issue about the economic development in the town that it's located in Eastern Oregon, it's a significant percentage of the economic interest of that community, and it would be like to say, no, well, we'll close OHSU in Portland and to hear the uproar. And so it is an issue about economic development in that community, and so I appreciate the sensitivity in addressing that concern.
Thank you, Representative. Are both these mics on?
These are the silver microphones.
Just silver mic. Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. Any other questions or comments? All right. I would entertain a motion to accept the Dash 1 amendments.
Madam Chair, I would move the Dash 1 amendments to House Joint Resolution 51.
Representative Gelser moves the Dash 1 amendments to HJR 51. Any comments? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It passes. Representative Gelser?
Yes, I would move House Joint Resolution 51 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gelser?
May I rephrase? Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House Joint Resolution 51 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation.
Representative Gelser moves HJR 51 to the floor with a do adopt, do as amended to be adopted on the floor. Susan, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Yellen?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Gelser? Aye.
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 Aye. Having the constitutional majority, House HJR 51 as amended goes to the floor with a suggesting that it be adopted. So we'll move on to Carrier. Representative Gelser, would you like to carry that?
I would have to think about it very carefully.
Oh, well.
But yes, I would be happy to do that.
Right. Thank you, Representative Gelser. Representative Gelser is a new aunt as of, a half hour ago?
Yes.
Oh.
Her name is NIL.
NIL?
Yes, NIL.
We don't N-I-L? Speak in acronyms here.
A-E-N-A-E-L-L-E. Oh. NIL.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. Okay, so where are we?
I've never heard that.
So we're going to open up House Bill 3524. Okay, Andy, you want to tell us about this bill?
Yes, thank you, Chair. House Bill 3524. Is a measure that was sponsored by Representative Olson of the committee. It's a measure that would establish the mental health database to assist law enforcement officers in assisting mentally ill individuals to obtain medical, mental health, and social services. It would become operative on July 1st, 2008. I know Representative Olson will go into this in detail, but there's also a consent component of the bill. It's based on the written consent of an individual.
Thank you. And we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 people signed up to testify. And if you haven't signed up we're having two different bills, as you've probably seen. And this is testimony just for this one bill. So if you haven't signed up to testify, and if you would like to, we'll have another sheet over there for you to sign up. So, Representative Olson.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative in Albany, this House District, and welcome to Albany, might I add. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to come before you today with House Bill 3524. I spent 29 years with the Oregon State Police, and I'd like to just kind of share a couple of the examples as I move into this, giving you a framework of where I'm wanting to go with this whole House bill. The idea really kind of surfaced last year when I was on the Joint Judiciary Committee. And during that time period, we listened to testimony for about 8 hours one day dealing with mental health issues. Sheriff Raul Ramirez from Marion County had shared and testified what the impact was to receiving the mental ill folks in his jails, and that also that he identified the jails were the largest recipient or holder of people with mental health issues in the state. And that kind of bothered me because it caused me to reflect back on some of the incidents that I recalled having been on the road as a trooper and then going up through the ranks and everything. And that's why I've asked some of my former colleagues here from Marion County as well as from Linn County Sheriff's Office to share today. The idea is that this is how simple it is. Let me give you an example here. The incident recently, and I know that Representative Gelser can share one that you heard yesterday in committee as well, but recently, as of last month, we had an incident, if you recall, of a lady, an elderly lady, that was confused where she was at. She was from the metropolitan area. She was en route trying to find Wilsonville. She got stopped in Newburgh. She was issued a citation by an officer there for reckless driving. He directed her to try to find where Wilsonville was. She still did not find Wilsonville. Then she was issued a citation the next time, later on that evening, at Estacada. Again, she was trying to locate, find out where Wilsonville was. You know, that was a perfect example to me of someone that was suffering from either Alzheimer's or dementia. If a family would have had the opportunity through this House bill to have been able to provide that information through the law enforcement data system, which I'll refer to as LEDS, which is connected with the Oregon State Police, with the information of just name, date of birth, what their problem is, who you could contact in case an officer did stop, that could have maybe been diverted. Because generally, most police officers, when they do make contact with somebody of that nature, do run a check. And that would have surfaced through LEDS. That could have, you know, could have been resolved quite easily. I'm thinking of another incident when I returned back to Albany here in 1998 as the station commander, that an elderly gentleman, this gentleman did have Alzheimer's. And he was coming up from Roseburg. He was en route back home to the metropolitan area in Portland. Got really, you know, just disoriented where he was at. Trooper stops him for kind of reckless driving type thing and realized maybe, you know, the gentleman was having a difficult time knowing where he was at. But he was also running out of gas. So the trooper took time out to lead him to a service station off of Highway 34 and I-5, which is the Corvallis interchange, and then basically let him go at that point. It was several hours later, the individual ran out of gas over in the Corvallis area, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, he got ran over by a semi-truck walking up north of Corvallis on 99W. He was disoriented, didn't know where he was at, but he was suffering from Alzheimer's. So this is what would be kind of handy to have, that potential to be able to access that, I think, for law enforcement. And then besides that, there's no need to investigate a crime where someone might be there involved with criminal trespass second degree, which is a minor misdemeanor. And it's not so much that it was an intentional or a culpable mental state issue, but that it was an issue that really involved they didn't know what was going on because of maybe the disease, so it was affecting them. So rather than hauling them off and placing them in a county jail where there's really not a sufficient amount of room, you had the opportunity to call somebody to have them come and get them and relieve that problem right then and there. And I see this as really being kind of a neat thing. I realize that the bill has some things that we need to work on. I appreciate this opportunity to be here again because I'm looking forward to listening to the testimony tonight to maybe make this even better than what it is right now. So that's kind of where I'm at. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Representative Gelser?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Olson, thank you for bringing this bill. I wanted to ask you a couple of questions that we've talked about before but were important to me when we started talking about this. How are the rights of the people whose information would go into this database protected? Do they know, and what kind of protections, if any, are put around offering consent to have information included?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking that question, Madam Chair and Representative Gelser. The bill is designed that it's a voluntary situation, first of all, and that it would be involved in LEDS. That itself is a controlled situation. And the only ones that can access LEDS right now are those who are certified through the law enforcement data system, the Oregon State Police, in order to do that. So that would be your protection and your safeguards with it.
Follow up. If I wanted to use this, could I just walk into a police station or a law enforcement by myself and do this because someone suggested that I should?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, if I could clarify what you're asking. If you yourself were wanting to do it, I mean, become entered into the system? Is that your, or are you inquiring?
I think that the point of my question is that by nature, some individuals are very vulnerable to suggestion or for people taking advantage of them. And so the idea of consent, saying I give permission if someone is exerting undue influence over me. And I'm wondering if there is protection in the bill. Am I correct that there's a part here where it's not just a person signs, that there's a mental health professional that's helping that person, walking them through what they're consenting to?
That is correct, yes. Yeah. So there is a process there, and the piece that I need to shore up a little bit more with this is that, in fact, besides a mental health professional being involved or a doctor signing off on this, that there would also be a piece that a public notary would be involved as well.
Can I do another follow-up?
Of course. I just want to point out that in line 28 mm-hmm. and 29, it says a written consent must be witnessed by a physician or licensed psychologist. But, of course, you can have another question.
Thank you. Could I, if I had a friend or a loved one or a spouse that had mental illness, could I, without their knowledge or consent, go and have this information added into the LEDS database?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, at this point, the way this is designed right now, that would not reflect or support what you just asked for. But that's a part that I do want to have identified in this, in case, you know, you do, like, for example, the situation I gave to you with the elderly lady from Portland. She herself would probably not have volunteered to do this. I don't know. But family members that were familiar with her, that in case of a potential driving situation like that did occur, would be able to be in a position to do that. That's what I'm interested in.
Okay.
I'm going to follow up then on that, because on line 25 and 26, it says, before entering information that identifies an individual into the database, the Department of State Police shall obtain the express written consent of the individual. But you are looking at perhaps an amendment that might alter that somewhat.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Could I follow up with one more question? That wasn't the answer that I thought I was getting. I guess both as the bill is written and in terms of what your vision of future amendments are, if a person wanted their information removed, could they have that happen? If the information was in, could they pull the information out?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, would be probably the same situation as what's used right now in the process of wanting to have a driver's license removed or suspended of an individual. There's a number of processes that you can obtain and go through, and in order for a person to be reinstated, that also would be the reverse process would apply. So what I'm meaning by that is that if the individual was well and became well, you would have to kind of have a reverse process to show that had occurred.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
And as I read it in your bill, in lines 29 and 30, the form shall clearly state that consent by the mentally ill person is voluntary and that consent is revocable.
That's correct.
Great, thank you. Any further questions? Yes.
Representative Olson, question on line 29 about the physician or licensed psychologist. In rural areas, that physicians are not always available, and that you have other primary care providers that are licensed in this state that do a substantial amount of treatment of those individuals that have mental health issues. Would you consider expanding that list of available providers, because there seems to be there are a number of checks in this. I suppose you're looking for support to the diagnosis that someone has a condition.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Maurer, that would be correct. And actually, there's some people here that I know that would really be great people to answer that question tonight from their perspective as well.
Great. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, I'm particularly interested in your 29 years of experience with the state police. And I wonder if you could just say a little bit about the practical side of this. By that I mean, I was talking to Representative Cowan earlier today. We've had experiences where I've done a ride-along before, and in Salem often police officers will encounter folks that have at some time been in the Oregon State Hospital or some other facility, and they often are having difficulty with their behavior or with reentry. And officers from Salem will identify those individuals right away. And what I noticed was that their tension level went immediately down because they have had previous experiences, they know the individual, and it's not as serious as maybe the call sounded, is what from a layman's standpoint. What I'm interested from you is to talk a little bit about that. What about that, this information would broaden the ability for the officers to assess and, I don't know if the right word is stand down, but certainly approach in a different manner than maybe the call would originally call for.
Sure, I understand. Anyways, Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, it's kind of almost a double-edged sword you could address. I mean, to some degree, it could create a false security for the law enforcement officer, knowing that all of a sudden, depending on what the circumstances are of the individual and everything, that they might relax with that. But on the other hand, it clearly would give you some good, solid direction as to what they're facing and dealing with at that time. And again, I'll give you another example. This is First Sergeant down in Cottage Grove responded to an incident where it was a son that was seriously was a mental health issue and had struck his mom several different times, and we showed up. You know, at that point, rather than taking the time out to spend several hours with the child for a police officer hold and then take him to the hospital because of the situation that Cottage Grove existed, we ended up choosing, rather than to transport him to Eugene and detain him under the juvenile detention situation.
Quick follow-up. That's a far more sophisticated approach, of course, than I would have as an untrained individual. So bottom line is, the more information, the better for the officer and for the whole situation.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Gilliam, to a degree. I mean, it's obvious that there's folks here that can share as well that how far we would be able to go with a voluntary situation.
Any further questions? Thank you very much, okay, Representative.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to call Judy and Virgil Wilson.
Thank you very much. I'm Judy Wilson, and my husband and I are the co-presidents of NAMI Mid-Valley. And thank you for being here in Albany this evening. And I also want to express our appreciation and thanks to Andy Olson and to Sarah, who have listened to us as advocates and who are trying to the best of their ability to understand the issues that we are facing every day as family members with family members who have a mental illness. I appreciate this House Bill 3524, Representative Olson. There are things about it that I feel are special and okay. There are questions that we have and the state NAMI has. They have written a letter of support to you for this as a beginning step in helping to solve some of the issues that we feel so strongly about as family members And those issues basically are the, there's so many mentally ill people in our jails, in our prisons today. 20%, and it goes way up to 60% in some of the jails and prisons, are people being incarcerated when they should be receiving services instead in our communities. And so we feel that this would be an asset. The other thing that we are greatly disturbed about is the little understanding sometimes with the police and the sheriff involved, as our people, our family members are not doing well, have decompensated perhaps, have gone off of their medications, and have been tasered and shot and killed in a lot of our cities in Oregon, including Corvallis and including Portland. We hear this so often, and so this, I believe, could be a great help, this bill, along with the crisis intervention training that I feel and we all feel as in NAMI is so essential for our police and our sheriff departments to have, so that they can understand what mental illness is better. And the 40 hours is necessary, not just the 12 that they perhaps receive. But we must have this training as well to accompany this database that, you know, does have its problems. And we are the first ones to agree that it does have a lot of problems. And we have some of our clients here tonight that will express to you their concern about it. But I think it is a beginning, and it is certainly going to be an asset, one of the things that will help solve this problem. Thank you
very much.
My name is Virgil Wilson, and as Judy said, we're co-presidents of the local NAMI affiliate. House Bill 3524 has been endorsed by our state NAMI group, and Judy and I also endorse this bill. The idea of being able to solicit and elicit help for someone in a crisis situation, I think, is paramount. And I feel that the confidentiality portions of the bill are generally satisfactory and will protect the rights and the confidentiality of almost anyone. I think this could be looked at as an advance directive for a lot of people. And in that regard, we would have liked to have seen, that other persons at risk might be included in this database. For instance, people with diabetes have similar problems to people with Alzheimer's and mental illness at times. There was a very well documented and notorious incident several years ago out on Highway 20 with a diabetic lady or gentleman. I don't remember the details, but I do know that the outcome would have been different had the officers on the scene known that they were dealing with somebody that had diabetes. That's one thing that we would like to see possibly included and enlarged in the bill. Another is we worry about and think about children under 18. Okay? There are juveniles that might be in need of some contact also. You know, I don't know how the state laws handle juveniles, but they, particularly the 15, 16, 17-year-olds, can become at risk. And on line, on the back on line 6 and 7, the contact persons, I think we would like that the bill might be modified to not limit who the client might identify as a contact person. You know, I mean, it might be a spouse, it might be a friend. You know, I would not limit who they could list as their contact. And on the next line down, or the number 9, line number 9, a list of medications, to keep that updated in the database might be a problem. But, you know, I don't know whether that would be worth trying to keep current, you know, because lots of folks' medications change quite frequently. I didn't mean those to be criticisms of the bill. I intended that those would be more as modifications and hopefully improvements. And with that, as I say again, we do endorse this bill, and I think the idea is very, very good, that we could find someone in crisis, find a contact for them, instead of, you know, the normal go to jail procedures.
Thank you so much. Any quick questions of these folks? Representative Gelser.
Not so much a question. I just wanted to thank Judy and Virgil, who are just such exemplary advocates, who are at every town hall, every meeting, raising the question and the needs of people with mental illness, and really helping to lead the charge to make things better. So thank you for your unwavering, tireless, and many, many, many years of advocacy that have made a difference for a lot of families.
Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair. Yeah, thanks, Judy and Virgil. And ditto what Representative Gelser said. I'm just curious, on the folks that would be eligible to submit information like this to LEDS on behalf of you know, someone, a beloved person or something in their life. Do you see it, the possibility of it also kind of, besides just not next of kin or a physician or something like that, being extended over to maybe a treatment center? And as the individual is released, they're recognizing the potential, what may exist for them in the future?
Might be a possibility, but it would also have some issues, I think, with some of the clients who might feel uncomfortable doing that. I don't know.
Unfortunately, mental illness carries an awful lot of stigma and baggage with it. And, you know, I feel sometimes that, you know, that we shouldn't continue to, you know, specifically identify and emphasize mental illness, and yet if we don't learn to speak of it freely and openly, you know, we'll never beat the stigma. We'll never get rid of discrimination unless we can get it out in the open. And so your question, sir, with regard to a treatment center, they probably have a specific release at the treatment center that someone probably assigned when they go in for treatment, as a matter of fact. And so that could possibly be a part of the debriefing as they leave.
Thank you so much. You know, we've taken over a half hour.
I'm sorry.
No, it's not your problem. It's ours. I don't think we had any idea how many people would show up. And I'm just feeling we've got two bills to hear tonight. And I think that I'm hearing from Representative Olson that he wants to work more on this bill. He knows you folks. And I think that maybe we can work privately. What do you think, Representative Olson?
Madam Chair.
I don't like cutting anybody okay. off, but I also see a lot of people here who are wanting to testify this evening. And as I said, we have two bills.
Okay.
And I'm going to be asking people if you could possibly hold your testimony to 3 minutes, and I'm going to ask my vice chair here to help me do that. If you can hold your testimony to 3 minutes, and then that would give us maybe a couple of minutes to ask questions, I'd sure appreciate it if you can do that. But we'll see what we can do. Bob and Gina Nickel, can we have you up now, please? And folks, if you have written testimony, feel free to give it to our staff here. Even if you've only got just one sheet, if you don't have copies for everybody, that's okay. After you give your testimony, just give it to our lovely Susan over here, and we'll make copies of it for everybody.
Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, and members of the committee, my name is Bob Nickel, Assistant Director, Department of Human Services, Addictions, and Mental Health Division. Normally, I would allow my wife to go first, and she has preferred to wait until after I say a few words. First thing I want to do is to say that the position that the department has on the bill is neutral. At this point, we have some concerns about it, and I'll outline those quickly here and be off the mic here in less than 3 minutes, I think. I've provided written testimony so you can take a look at that, and it has a few more details than I'll say now. The purpose of this bill is, and the intent is laudable, and we really appreciate Representative Olson, your work in this area and your concern. As I read this bill, and I was actually working on this last night because I hadn't had a chance to take a look at it in detail. As I read the bill, I had some concerns, and I'll tell you briefly about them. The bill, as it's written and as it's drafted, I'm not sure if this was the intention or not, but as kind of a technical expert in this area, the population that this bill would apply to as it's written is a very narrow population. We serve about 70,000 adults each year. This bill applies to those adults who have been civilly committed twice in the previous 3-year period of time and are demonstrating substantially similar symptoms to those which got them committed in their previous episodes. Now, in my experience, this is probably going to be less than 1,000 people. We only civilly commit about 1,000 people a year in the state. And this is an even narrower funnel that the bill has been drafted to include. Plus, it would be those people who are demonstrating symptoms similar to what they had the last time. Plus, and I respect this part of the bill very much and supported it, it would require the person's consent, expressed written consent. I'm guessing, though I don't have good data on this yet, that it's probably fewer than 200 people and maybe even smaller than that who would actually be willing and able to sign the consent to get entered in the database. On one hand, that's good because it makes the implementation much easier when you have a relatively small number, but I'm not sure if that was really the intent. Sometimes when legislative council drafts these things, they take parts of the statute in which it looks like they did. My staff did not catch this. I was around 25 years ago when this particular provision was inserted into the law, and I helped direct a program that worked with the people who we called the risk pool clients at that time. So I have my own personal experience in working with this. These are very difficult, challenging clients. They're usually people who have not been engaged very well, and they require a lot of outreach, and they tend to be very suspicious and standoffish. So I wanted to point out that that's something that might require a little bit more attention. The other issue I think that Mr. Wilson mentioned was that medications and some of the other things that are required in the bill or could be listed in the database do change, and I think there are going to be issues there that we need to think through carefully about how to make sure that if we create a database, it's not outdated, you know, in a week or two, and how we would actually do that piece. I think the other thing that I want to say is that I think the bill has some really good features, as I mentioned, requiring written consent. It does not run afoul of HIPAA, the health insurance, portability and accountability acts, privacy regulations. In fact, if I remember right, it specifically mentions them. I also think that it's got some good features in that it requires close collaboration between my department, the state police, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and advocacy groups, and as well as increased training. So in conclusion, the department would be willing to work some more with the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any quick questions of Mr. Nickel? Thank you so much.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gina Nickel, Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. The association is also taking a neutral stance at this time. We really appreciate the conversation and the concept of this bill that we've had with Representative Olson and many of you. But the one thing that we want to really express our desire for is to have a further conversation with the people that this bill is intended to serve. This bill does target a very small group. And we think that it's very, very important to talk to the people that this bill is going to serve to make sure that things are addressed. Law enforcement should be able to depend on a fully funded mental health system that provides them with crisis intervention training. That training right now is very, very narrow, indeed, not close to the 40 hours that CIT training is required. Medications, living situations, circumstances, and symptoms change. And so we have a concern that the database would not be updated regularly, so that might be an issue. I also want to point out that the line on page one talking about witness by a physician and a licensed or a licensed psychologist, that also could be an issue, especially as Representative Maurer said, in a rural area. So we would need to look at that. In an ideal system, really, whether it's county or regional, we would have a fully funded mobile crisis team and a crisis triage center. Law enforcement could hand this off and not really have to deal with people with mental illnesses that exhibit their symptoms. This still carries stigma in it. We still don't treat mental illness the way we should, as what it is, a disease. I have worked professionally as a crisis intervention specialist with both the military and law enforcement. I appreciate the integrity and the thought behind this bill, and this association stands ready to work with all partners, and especially the people that this bill is intended to serve, to work through any additions we might have.
Thank you, Ms. Nickel. Any questions of Ms. Nickel? I saw her first, but you're next.
Representative Cote. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here. I've heard a couple times now the limitations of the population, and I've read this a couple times now, and I'm not seeing that, so maybe someone can help me, because the first line says the person, one or more of the following, either small a, small b, small c. So I just want to clarify that. Am I reading that correctly? Or it's not just folks who have been civilly, I mean, the C category is a fairly limited population, but the A and B might not. Or I'm just wondering if I'm misreading that.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotak, if you'll look at the first page on line 11, also the big B is chronically mentally ill and within the previous 3 years has twice been placed in a hospital or an approved inpatient facility. That also limits.
Correct, but that is a modification of line 9.
Mm-hmm.
But you could be also line 7 or line 6. You don't have to be line 9.
Correct.
Okay.
This is still a more limited population than the 70,000 that Bob was talking about in his testimony. I think my concern is that this is looked as this will take care of the imagined and real problem, and I'm not sure that it completely will. So we want to talk about that more, how we deal with that.
Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, actually going back to the previous folks that testified, they talked about just general health issues. Diabetes was a specific example. And it seems in what we see is in a primary care setting is that there are a lot of people that have conditions that may impact them, not for criminal behavior, but loss of orientation, and at their beginning stages of dementia, or they've got a serious condition, diabetes, that they really, it's really a fragile state. So I look at this, I'm rethinking this as more of a mental health, a health database as opposed to mental health. And mental health can be one of the conditions that may be allowed in this system, but there are other conditions that may be permitted. Clearly, if the patient says, yes, I would like law enforcement to know that I have this condition, I don't see where that starts to run afoul of privacy issues. It's, I think it's where you go further on the continuum of mental health issue, depression and et cetera, that's where the privacy issue might come in play.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments? All right. Yes.
Madam Chair, if I could, I would like to try to respond to the question that Representative Kotek raised. I think that part of what I think we need to do is sit down and have a discussion about who really this is intended. A very literal reading could read the way Representative Kotek has brought it up. One of the problems here is who decides whether the person is dangerous to self or others. Does that require meeting the threshold of civil commitment? Does it require all of these other things? And I think those are just things that we would need to talk through to clarify. I can see the interpretation Representative Kotek is bringing up, though, and I just wanted to thank you for pointing that out.
Thank you so much. And we will call up Sheriff Tim Mueller and Chris Hoy, is it?
I'm Troy Clausen, and I would like to go to
the... That's fine.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Thanks for having me here tonight. I just have, just real briefly, several things, just locally. I'll be way under the three-minute rule, believe me.
Thank you.
I've worked at the Sheriff's Office for a long time, be 23 years this year. I started off working in the jail back when we still had mental health facilities available, before the early 1990s, when a lot of those facilities were closed and beds were limited. There were, like what Representative Olson was discussing earlier, there was a vehicle in place to where law enforcement, the first place that they would go was not the county jail. And over the years, it's regressed into that is where people with mental health needs wind up going, unfortunately. And a lot of it has to do with the response of the law enforcement officer on the street. What do I do with this person? I need to get him somewhere where he's safe and other people are also safe. Locally, our committals by our mental health specialists we have working in the jail through the county mental health department has, and for our numbers of commitments last year were 14 for the whole calendar year. Year to date for 2007, they're up to 26. So it's we definitely have a problem in Linn County, especially. There are a considerable number of new people that are coming into our jail that we haven't seen before, and in the previous years, it's up about 6%. And these people have never had any law enforcement contact in Linn County, and where they're coming from, they're all over the state, outside of the state. So, and again, there needs to be a vehicle put in place to where jail for these folks is not the first option. So that's all I have for you today. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them for
you. Good questions. Thank you so much. I'm going to call Megan, and I'm not sure, Coughlin? Yes. and Jody Parker. Just say who you are.
I'm Megan Cahe. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to testify. I'm testifying opposed to this bill. I am someone who has known mental health issues for more than 30 years. I've been hospitalized over 100 times in the course of my life for psychiatric issues. I've had shock treatments. I've been on medications for over 30 years. And I've had, because of my behavior at certain times, I've had chances where I've been had contact with both police and sheriffs. So I feel like I can say something from my personal experience about this bill. When I first read the text of this bill, my first response was, well, I was very struck by, I could tell what good intentions the writers of the bill had. And I appreciated that people were working so hard to make something better for people who are suffering from mental health issues. And my first response was, well, this might be a good thing. And that lasted for about 15 minutes as I absorbed the finer details of the bill. When I looked at the provision for the informed consent, I thought about what it's been like for me to be in the office of a psychiatrist or a mental health therapist. And I've often had to sign different things, been asked to sign consent forms or treatment plans. And there really is a very strong, I haven't actually felt like I had much choice about whether to sign something. There's a great sense of being compelled to sign something. I think this is true for a lot of people. You feel like the person in authority has the power, and it was only very late in my treatment that I felt empowered enough to say, yes, I'll sign something on my own behalf, or that I felt really that I could say, this is my choice. So I think people could feel forced to sign consent. I don't think many people would feel empowered enough to say, no, I don't want to be in the database. So that's a real concern. Now, I've reflected on the times when I've been with police and sheriffs, and I've actually had some positive experiences with sheriffs. I had some fairly negative experiences with police, but there have been some very caring sheriffs who have shown me support and compassion. And I think really what could work is that people could have more training. What could work is there could be peer-run support, respite care for people. There could be more money put in peer support and community-based programs. This is what I think would be of use. I think SB 363, that this is a bill that will help improve the mental health of our state, and we need to support that. Also, what concerns me is that this bill would separate people out that have mental health issues it would make us separate. And as someone who's been hospitalized a lot and who has mental health issues, it would be an affront to my dignity. And for me, it violates my human rights.
Megan, could you take one more minute and finish up?
Yes, I'll do that. I'll take less than a minute. It hurts my dignity and violates my feelings of self-determination. And dignity and self-determination are what help people recover. And so it really works against the dissolving of stigma. And dissolving stigma is what we need. So thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you so much for sharing with us. We really appreciate it.
Hi. Thank you for allowing me to speak and for coming here. This is very important, and I'm glad that you're going to listen to us. My name is Jody Parker. I represent Mind Freedom Oregon Advisory Committee for Corvallis and the surrounding area. And I've been in the mental health system in Benton County and the city of Eugene for 26 years, nearly all of my adult life. I understand there's good intention to help people with mental illness, but I feel this is really not the way to go. The bills are dangerous to people with the label mentally ill. There are a lot of flaws with this bill, but the crux of the matter of the problem is the written and voluntary consent. You can give consent, but it's always harder to undo. And I would like to say that when a person isn't feeling well, when you're not thinking your best, when you're isolated from family and friends, it's easy to be pressured into signing something. For example, last spring of 2006, it had been 10 years since I'd been an inpatient. After months of sleep loss, I had become extremely physically and mentally exhausted. I couldn't care for myself. I was admitted into the Samaritan Regional Mental Health in Corvallis. After going through two locked doors and entering a strange environment, I was led into a small room. Within minutes, a man came into my room and presented me with a document that was pages and pages long. I hadn't slept for a long time. I was not doing well. I couldn't read something simple, and he gave me this document. So within minutes, I signed it and initialed all the pages. And then he left. And I couldn't say no at the time. I'd been in the hospital twice in solitary confinement. Once I was in the Good Samaritan Hospital ER, and I thought I could refuse treatment. I verbally refused, and I was put into four-point restraint for 4 hours and put into a solitary room. And so I didn't think I could say no, and I was an adult. And how would you feel would you have peace of mind if you signed something and didn't know what it was? I was in the hospital for 26 days. I was never given a copy of that document to read. And to this day, I have not seen that document. I don't know what I signed. So I was an adult, and this bill says, for contact persons, for parents, guardians, and foster care. It doesn't say anything about spouse or so forth. It seems to be aimed at children. Anyway, the establishment of a mental health database sets a precedent of blacklisting certain disadvantaged citizens with the unfortunate psychiatric label of mentally ill. Once set, this precedent, a slippery slope, will open the door for in the future when any citizen with a psychiatric label could be added to this database, and possibly without written consent. Right now, a person may be treated privately as ill, but this bill makes it written in stone that we are regarded by the state as governmentally, officially ill, and that's a huge difference. And I'd also like to mention that the 1040 is also supposedly voluntary compliance. Yet if you don't voluntarily comply with that, you get a knock on the door. So just like to say that. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Any quick questions?
Representative Kotek. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, both of you, for being here. I'm very compelled by the idea of the coercive environment around the written consent. Would adding additional individuals around physician or licensed psychologist, maybe a personal advocate, some, and I'm not saying that would necessarily fix it, but would that help? Because I understand if it's just you and a medical professional, there is a power differential there. I don't know if you have a suggestion there, something we could to make that a little better if we could. I don't know.
Well, I think a person would be just coerced. I just think there's just too much coercion and, like, there's not enough self-determination. I was, every time I've been in the hospital, I was put on medications when I was about 21. And every single time I was in the hospital was because the drugs failed. And I truly believe that had I not been put on medications back then and given more behavioral help, which is what I sought. I sought for help with a behavior problem, an eating disorder, and I was given medications. And when the medications fail, sometimes they can leach out of your system, for example, and they put you into a psychotic disorder, and then you're taken to the hospital. What I'm saying is that the system doesn't allow for self-determination. When going into the hospital is not a pleasant experience. It hurts your self-esteem, and often you never come out of it. And when children, which is what it seems to, the bill says, seems to suggest underage people, I think it's not a good idea to put young children into the system, and then once they're in for adults, because you're told that you're chronically ill the rest of your life, you must be on medications.
Thank you so much, Ms. Parker.
Okay. And also in the future, there's going to be Teen Screen, and that's aimed at children, putting children on ADHD drugs and so forth. Once you have a population put on drugs as young children, and they're said you have to be on them the rest of your life, the drugs fail often, and often you go into the hospital only for
that
the
really
failure.
Not the purview of this bill, but we really appreciate you coming to testify, both of you.
Oh, I was just pointing out the future, what will happen in the future. You will be having more people in jails,
thank
more
you.
People and mentally ill, and I think it's going to be a problem.
We have Frank Moore,
thank you.
Becky Child, and Terry O'Connell. Oh, no, we've only got two. Usually we have three seats, but now we've only got two, so... Frank Moore and Becky Child.
Chair Tomei and fellow committee members, my name is Becky Child, and I'm the president of the Mental Health Association of Oregon and PeerLink Oregon. And we are comprised primarily of, our board is primarily 51% of people who have used or currently use mental health services. And we are opposed to this bill. We appreciate the intent of the bill. But we have several concerns. First of all, I would like to state, I don't know if you're aware, but the Portland Police have a similar database that's not connected to the LED system. However, what I found out recently because of the work that I do is that officers don't have access to that in their cars. They can only access it at a precinct station. What I was told is that there's a little note on the monitor in their car that comes up that says that there's information in the database about those people. Another issue is that it's voluntary across the board. Anybody who wants to be in that database can go and sign up if they choose to, regardless of, and it can include people who have cerebral palsy. Sometimes they're mistaken as being intoxicated because they have difficulty walking. People who are hard of hearing or deaf that have some contact with law enforcement. It's a much broader population. Secondly, we would recommend a broad-based group to address amendments for this bill. I think there's some good intentions here. Perhaps if we can get a broad stakeholder appeal that we could work something out. We also have issue with doctor and psychologist. It needs to be simply voluntary. If people want to participate in this, they need to be allowed to do it without anybody signing off on their signature to say that they want to be a part of this. Also concerned about how this information gets included in other police information. If people have charges that are brought against them, is that information stay separate or does it somehow get aggregated over into the criminal charges? And a person may or may not want that information included in the police information that gets sent over to the district attorney's office. So I would have some concerns about this. The bill does not address that in any substantial way. I'm not satisfied with the regards to remove information. If somebody requests to have their information removed, it needs to be deleted completely. And the way this bill reads, I don't get that. It just says they'll remove identifying information. Similar concerns around medication and symptoms issues, because they do change. One of the things that I thought of as we're thinking here, that as Oregon prepares for disaster response and law enforcement is considered a first responder, having a database that addresses how to communicate with people who have difficulties, if you could focus on ways to work with people, if that was part of the database, is how does a law enforcement officer communicate with you in a way that can be successful if you're having a hard time? That's a very different question and is actually more helpful than whether or not they're on a certain medication or not, or what the those are just some broad recommendations really quickly, and some concerns and suggestions for this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much. It's always good to see you.
Yes, thanks.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
Good evening and welcome to Albany. My name is Frank Moore. I'm the mental health administrator and public health administrator, mental health director for Linn County. And I'd have to say this is my office is across the street. This is the shortest distance I've ever traveled to a legislative hearing. I'll be very quick. You have a copy of my testimony in front of you. I neither oppose nor support this bill in its current form. I believe the aim of the bill is laudable. I'm not sure that that's the best way to safeguard not only our communities and law enforcement officers and persons with mental illness. In the best of all possible worlds, we would have adequately funded community mental health programs that could respond 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in person, on the street, if need be. We currently do have that capacity at our local hospitals and actually can access a database of Linn County Mental Health for anybody that is known to us. As Sheriff Mueller stated, many of the people that we run into don't have or aren't in our system. Therefore, I think that access to community mental health programs and training for law enforcement officials, the crisis intervention training, and an extensive training, I think, would enhance any services and the public safety to people with mental illness. So I am more than willing to help through whatever venue you like to help refine or work with the expectations or goals of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Any quick questions for Mr. Moore or Ms. Child? Thank you both for coming. Terry O'Connell and Bob Jundep.
Excuse me. Good evening, Madam Chair. My name is, and members of the committee. My name is Terry O'Connell, and I'm with the Oregon State Police, and I'm the Director of Criminal Justice Information Services, commonly known as LEDS. Our mission is primarily to provide information to law enforcement officers for their safety and the safety of the public. We currently do provide access to the Department of Human Services Civil Commitment Database through LEDS for a couple of specific purposes dealing with weapons possession and weapons purchase. We look forward to working with Representative Olson and his committee and members of the DHS to work on this bill to make it a more viable tool for law enforcement folks. I'm open to any questions.
That was lovely and brief. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you so much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundep. I'm from the Oregon Advocacy Center. And I've submitted some testimony for you that tries to outline a few of the issues that we see in the bill, and maybe some suggestions too that to try to address the purpose of the bill. And I have to say that in many hearings that I attend, there's two sides sort of fighting it out, and this is a situation in which I hear the same thing being said, which is that we all need to be working together to try to address the problems that our communities face and people with mental illness face in terms of getting services. I'd like to add one thing, is that I will confess here that I am a lawyer. In my capacity as a lawyer, back in the early 90s, I proposed a advanced directive for mental health treatment and ended up working in a committee, a task force, to develop what is today our Declaration for Mental Health Treatment, which is in Oregon law. And I can tell you that it took many, many meetings to hammer out the details of in weighing confidentiality issues and sensitivities of families and sensitivities of consumers in order to come up with a product that everyone could live with. Part of that, I'll just give you an example, which may be counterintuitive, but if you look in that particular statute, you'll see that there need to be two signatures to witness a person agreeing to an advanced directive for mental health treatment. And there are certain people who are specifically prohibited from acting as witnesses, and one of those people is the treating physician. And that was a message from the consumers who were involved in that process of saying, I feel that I would be coerced into signing this document either to get out of the hospital, it would be a prerequisite to my getting out of the hospital, or I would be presented with papers that I didn't really understand and couldn't see but felt I had to sign them. So it's a sensitivity that I think is important to recognize. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any quick questions? Thank you both, gentlemen. And that was very quick. Let's see. Chris Hay and Troy Clausen, is it?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Commander Chris Hoy. I'm with the Marion County Sheriff's Office. I'm the jail commander there. I'm here to speak about House Bill 3524, and like several others, I'm not taking a position either for or against, but I just want to provide the committee with information. I have a sort of a diagram that I've created that I think outlines the system and a lot of what you've already heard today. But I would like to just go over it with you and talk about my perspective on this issue. In Oregon, the responsibility for helping mentally ill people in crisis has fallen to the criminal justice system. A system that is designed to provide a law enforcement response to a medical problem is one doomed for failure from the outset. My goal today is to identify areas where the system is broken and suggest some potential solutions. Currently, when somebody is in a mental health crisis, generally speaking, law enforcement is the only viable intervention available to citizens. Police officers and sheriff's deputies are called to the scene, where often no information about a person's history is available. In most communities, while on the scene, with little or no background, law enforcement is left to resolve the situation with very few viable options. More often than not, the situation results in an arrest for a low-level misdemeanor such as criminal trespass to or disorderly conduct. The mentally ill person is then transported to the county jail, where the Oregon Health Plan stops automatically, if they had it to begin with. They're housed with criminals who often take advantage and manipulate unsuspecting individuals. Jails, I can assure you, are not equipped to treat persons with mental illness effectively. Oftentimes, the mentally ill person decompensates even more while in jail. In the best case scenario, the person will consent to and receive treatment. Because the mentally ill person is often in a state of crisis and is unable to communicate basic information, medical histories are often not available to jail medical staff. Excuse me. Jail staff will then be forced to seek a new diagnosis from a mental health professional. These new and unnecessary evaluations are costly and a waste of valuable resources. Once the new diagnosis is established, medications are ordered. In my jail alone, we have historically spent approximately $20,000 every month on psychotropic medications. $20,000 every month, just in my jail, one jail in Oregon. Funds for this medication come from our general fund. While the mentally ill person languishes in the correctional facility, they are housed with people arrested for every offense from the lowest theft all the way up to and including aggravated murder. Others are released while the mentally ill person is held because no viable alternative exists in the community. The criminals who are being released then go back into the community and more than likely will commit more crimes against more victims. This is one cost often overlooked when calculating the price of incarcerating mentally ill people. Once the mentally ill person is stabilized and released, they are sent back into the community with no medication and no ability to purchase any. Studies have shown that individuals in this situation spend significantly more time in custody than others charged with similar offenses who are not mentally ill. Appointments at community health programs can take weeks to establish. Even if an appointment is available, qualifying for indigent treatment is extremely difficult. While waiting for this appointment, the individual usually has no money for the expensive psychiatric medications. Decompensation begins. Once the situation devolves enough, the cycle starts all over again. We are turning people through a system that is doomed for failure. We need to establish viable non-jail alternatives for law enforcement, such as respite care and crisis centers. Mental health courts have proven to be effective and should become the rule rather than the exception. Crisis intervention training for law enforcement and correction staff should be funded statewide. Advocates and law enforcement must come together and fill the gaps in the system. Continuing to do what we've been doing is unconscionable and inhumane. The human toll on everyone involved is far too costly and must stop. I understand the drive behind House Bill 3524. It is an attempt to fill one of those gaps in the system. The true merit of this bill is that it sheds light on an ever-growing problem and provides impetus for all stakeholders to come together and develop solutions to fix this broken system. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chris. You too, go ahead.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Troy Clawson. I'm the commander of the Marion County Sheriff's Office, Parole and Probation Division. I'm also a certified police officer and served in such a capacity for almost 17 years within Marion County and the City of Independence in Polk County. I'm here to express our issues with House Bill 3524 and the way that the language of the proposed bill has been drafted. While I have personal knowledge that law enforcement and parole and probation deputies in Marion County have worked diligently in the area of mental health issues and dealing with individuals who have mental health concerns, a database housed at the law enforcement data system may not be the best approach to this growing concern. The necessity to provide law enforcement and public safety personnel with real data and life histories is a very good concept, a concept that very well could prevent use of force incidents up to and including the use of deadly force. However, the real issue here is the need for additional training for public safety personnel so when they encounter an individual who may not be taking their medication, maybe having a mental illness issue, or has used another substance to self-medicate, we can safely and effectively end a potential confrontation with the safety of the individual and the officer in mind. Furthermore, when the person is transported to the jail, if necessary, or better yet, to a facility where an evaluation can take place, the person is in a state where they can help provide for their own treatment. In my mind, the need for this information is increasing when individuals can no longer afford prescription medication, they combine their medications or prescriptions with other illicit drugs, or they don't take them at all. But putting them in a database may not be the best concept. I believe that the bill does propose some good ideas, and having a work group look at these issues and come up with potential solutions is certainly a start. Having advocacy groups, general citizenry, the Oregon State Police, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, DHS, and others at the table to discuss these issues by mandate is probably a good idea and, quite frankly, may be what it takes to get everyone there and to do the job. As far as the specific issues of the bill are concerned, a few of the questions that we in the law enforcement community have are why just the designation of hospital stay? If it's consent, why not include anyone with a mental illness who may have had a chronic problem, dementia, or Alzheimer's? How about a person with a chronic mental illness who consistently ends up in the jail but hasn't spent any time in hospitalization? The bill does have language for removal from the database, but what procedures are there to make sure that that happens? What's the time frame that removal has to be done in? And with police reports and incident reports, which are required within the law enforcement profession, How does law enforcement not include this particular information in that report? And if we do include it, is that all right? And are there any legal implications with having it in there, even if it's consensual that the person ended up in the database to begin with? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions? Seeing none. Thank you, gentlemen. We really appreciate your testimony. And I think the last person we've got is Marie Powell.
Hello, I'm Marie Parcell. I live in Corvallis, and I'm a member of an advocacy group that's been there for about 3 years, and we're trying to learn advocacy. And I've dealt with mental health issues, though I haven't been hospitalized or arrested, and I know many people who have mental health issues. I have very great concerns about this database bill. I recognize the intention as being very wonderful of trying to find a way to solve these problems that people run into with the police. I don't think this database will do that, however. One of the gentlemen who died in our town, the police knew he had mental health problems. They didn't need to look it up in a database. They knew that. And he still died. He was still killed. Also, I know that people can get on a database. It will skewer how ordinary behavior is seen, because I know of two women who were doing exactly the same thing, and this was quite a few years ago, and one of them had was known to the police as someone who has had mental struggles, and they were very concerned about what she was doing, and it was like they didn't even see the other woman with her who didn't have that. And they were basically doing the same thing. I don't want to go into details what it was. It wasn't against the law. They were concerned for their safety. So this might skewer how a person's behavior is seen if the police can actually access it and if it actually prevents them from overreacting, which I'm not certain that it would, whereas crisis intervention training to the degree that is needed, the 40 hours, that might actually really help. I've heard people mention concerns about people they don't know how to contact someone if they have Alzheimer's or if they have diabetes or epilepsy. But people could carry cards. I mean, someone knows if they have that kind of situation. They could carry cards with their name of the person to be contacted. It wouldn't have to be in a database. They could have they could carry ID, and I think that would be a really, you know, a matter of public education. If someone has a illness that might be misunderstood, they should carry something saying that. And finally, I know people could get coerced onto this database. I'm not sure how they'd get off again. I mean, they'd say, "Hey, I'm healthy enough, I'm not having problems, take me off your database." Could they actually get off? I'm not sure what the procedure would be for that. I think there's a great deal of problems already exacerbating what already is sort of a Q-tier movement, because people with mental struggles are treated differently already. So I think this would be more of a problem. I'm opposed to the database. I appreciate the problem you're trying to solve, and I think there's other ways to do it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We really appreciate it. That's the last person who has signed up to testify, obviously. Colleagues, we have our work set out for us, not only on this bill, but on mental health issues in general. And thanks to all of you who came to testify. We really appreciate it. And I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3524 and open up a hearing on House Bill 4995. And thank you, Representative Holder, for staying.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's obvious this is a very tough subject matter, and I commend the committee for bringing this up, and Representative Olson for his approach to this. I also have run into this scenario in my community.
down in Eugene, and I talked to Representative Olson about it earlier in the session when I said, oh, I tried to draft a bill that sort of talks about this scenario, because, you know, my problem with this whole scenario is that we really have to do something about trying to protect the people that are mentally ill out there, and when they get into situations with the police or with hospitals, it just seems like there's a lack of information being shared to help the individuals. And so my simple approach was just to allow care providers, hospitals, and the police or public agencies to share their confidential information with each other, not really sharing it with anybody else, keeping it confidential amongst themselves. And obviously that's not as easy as it sounds, and many are concerned about their privacy, and rightfully so. You know, it was just apparent to me that there are situations where individuals get into scenarios where they maybe have an episode with mental illness, and the police are called, and they're not able to contact the proper agencies or know who to contact or go to the hospitals, and just a lack of information amongst the healthcare providers and public safety just seems to be causing a great deal of danger for the mentally ill population. And so my intent was really, with my bill, was to open up this discussion with a slightly different concept, to allow healthcare care providers to have access to the information that they need so that they can help intervene in these situations. Sometimes, you know, the law enforcement that I've talked to in my town are troubled by this as well, because they're bound by confidentiality just like the healthcare provider is, and so they're not able to immediately share with the health community or the healthcare provider that may be able to help. And it just seemed like there's a real disconnect there. And it may be a simplistic idea, and I know there's some confidentiality issues, and I have asked legislative counsel to see if there was a way that confidential information from the healthcare point of view and from the law enforcement point of view can be shared both ways, not just to the law enforcement agencies, that they be able, law enforcement, also share that information with the providers. Because sometimes I think that the providers might be able to step in and really help diffuse a potentially dangerous situation and put, you know, work together on this more than working at it strictly as law enforcement and strictly as healthcare, to work together on this a little bit more. A tough situation, and I just thought I wanted to introduce my bill just for the concepts for your committee to consider when you're trying to grapple with this problem. I haven't had near the time to delve into this as Representative Olson has, but I think it is a subject matter that we do need to look at and try to figure out a way to address the concerns of privacy, because I think that the privacy can still be held within the community that needs to have it, only when they're dealing with the safety of providing those professional services. When that's the issue, that's when the information needs to be shared, when safety is it the issue. And I, as far as the database, you know, I didn't really put a lot of thought into how that information is shared. Maybe you have to have a database, maybe you don't. I don't know how you do it without some sort of database, you know, basically. But I think it is a tough issue, and I hope that the people that work on this particular bill will just consider that the information is already there in the police department or in the healthcare facility about a particular individual sometimes, and if we could just share it with each other on how best to handle a situation that when it arises. Yeah, I think that's just a concept I'd like you to consider, that was the intent of my bill, was just to be able to share the information to try to handle these situations when they arise, because sometimes maybe the police can get a hold of the case provider or get a hold of somebody who's working with that individual to come out and intervene, hopefully, to defuse a scenario that the police might not be totally trained in. And I just thought that since that expertise already exists, it's really difficult to get everybody trained up to be everything. So we need each other in trying to deal with this. And that was the basic intent of my bill, was to get the different agencies, the law enforcement, the health care providers, to work together when these situations arise, and instead of trying to deal with it by themselves. And I've also talked to some that are actually mental health providers or working care facilities, and in a particular judge and in the court system, where they also don't get the information they need from these different agencies as well when they're trying to deal with that individual. So it's we have a lot of different players in this. And, you know, although I really respect the rights to privacy that are expressed by the mentally ill patients and the mentally ill community, you know, the goal of this, I think, is really to provide better services to help keep them safe, and that's really the goal. And maybe we do need better funding for our mental health programs to be able to participate in this better. That's I can't deny that. That's really would be a huge help to this scenario. But I just think we need to work on this together from all different angles, and be able to step in when we're needed to provide the services safely. So thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. If there are any questions.
Madam Chair, this is more of a comment. I'm sitting on the Search and Rescue Task Force, and we have spent two full evenings, about 8 hours of work, dealing with the issue of privacy when there's
exigent
circumstances, when there's a crisis, and, you know, from a search and rescue standpoint. And the information that we heard about access even to credit card receipts or hotel information when someone's life is literally on the line, the whole issue of privacy since HIPAA has really, the pendulum's really swung, and people in a lot of cases inappropriately have overreacted. And so I think a lot of this is trying to correct that to where is the appropriate balance of protecting, you know, privacy, but getting the information to the people that need it in a timely manner. And so this is not just about health. It kind of cuts across a lot of privacy issues, and I, you know, applaud the attempt. And it's just, there's a lot of work to do, isn't there, ma'am?
Absolutely, Gary.
And, Madam Chair, one more comment. In regards to confidentiality, you know, we have actually some models where we have agencies that share confidential information amongst each other at the state level. And, you know, I think we really need to, as a state, challenge HIPAA somewhat when it comes to confidential information that can be shared by those that already have confidential information in public bodies, and certainly with healthcare providers, and they're licensed to have confidential information as well. It's not like that information is being broadcast to the public or made available to just anybody. It's being made available to those that need to have it to make sure that we can provide services safely, whether it's law enforcement or medical treatment.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much for bringing this bill to us, Representative. We have several people who have signed up. Bob Nickel, Bob Junduff.
No,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Bob Nickel, Assistant Director of DHS and responsible for Addictions and Mental Health Division. I'm here to testify in opposition to the bill, not because I disagree, again, with the intention here and the desire to keep people safe. The problem, and I've written testimony on this, is that the bill's language clearly does conflict with HIPAA. And I put into my testimony that HIPAA does allow for the transfer of some information if there is a serious and imminent threat. And it also has to be consistent with applicable law and standards of ethical conduct. So I would be happy to talk some more about the details of this, but that's essentially my testimony.
That is short and sweet. Thank you. Bob, why don't you go ahead and then we'll take
the question. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Junior from the Oregon Advocacy Center, and my testimony is almost identical to Mr. Nichols. In my written testimony, I provided you with the actual excerpt from the HIPAA regulations, and I think if you take a look at them, you can see that this area is pretty well governed, and given the detail of it, there's been an awful lot of thought that's gone into trying to weigh the various interests involved. So the other thing I would point out is that, again, and I would agree that I only acknowledge the best intentions behind this bill, but I do think it would also violate the Americans with Disabilities Act in that it singles out only a specific disabled group to come within its area of exemption from confidentiality, and that's people with mental illness. And I think that would be vulnerable to challenge as being discriminatory against that particular group.
Thank you. Let's see if there are quick questions from the committee. And thank you for presenting, both of you, presenting written testimony.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. And this might not, you might not be the right folks to answer this, but I'm just wondering, to what level of training do law enforcement folks get on HIPAA?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I don't know. I'm sure that if law enforcement training were expanded, as a number of people have discussed this evening, that's certainly something that could be included. I think right now the number of hours are so limited, I'd be really surprised.
Thank you. Further question? Oh, Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm interested in reading your testimony when we have an opportunity, first of all. But could you just say a little bit more? You say that this concern is adequately addressed. By that, do you mean, is it possible that the kind of information that Representative Holby is suggesting could be currently under state and federal law exchanged?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, I think that in certain instances it can be exchanged under state and federal laws that exist now. One thing's for sure, that particularly with the federal law, we would have a problem if we passed a statute in the state level that contradicted or expanded access to confidential information beyond what the federal law allows. So I think a significant degree it is addressed in the federal law already. And I'll, of course, leave it to you to be the judge of that.
Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Karen Scheller, I think. Okay. Becky Child and Megan Colley. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Yes.
Madam Chair, fellow committee members, again, I'm Becky Child from the Mental Health Association of Oregon, and I live in Portland, Oregon. We are also opposed to this bill. We are greatly concerned about the privacy issues. We believe that there is adequate language in the HIPAA statute currently. The problem is the interpretation. That's an administrative and bureaucratic feature to figure out what that means between agencies that takes work and people talking to each other. But it's not something that requires another statute that grossly overstates that. Additionally, somebody who's had personal experience with some privacy issues with my data being shared, I received services from a Portland area facility for
about 3 years, several years ago. I happened to, at the end of receiving that treatment, I asked for a copy of my record. And boy, was I surprised when I read what was in my record. And there was a lot of information in there that was grossly misrepresented. That would be the kind way to say it. Some of the information that was included in that record was egregiously incorrect. And I was really angry. And I would have some serious problems if that, and in fact, I refuse, I will not even acknowledge that I received treatment at that facility anywhere when I talk about my mental health history, because I don't want that, those records accessed because of that information. And I did work with one provider at one point who was connected to that facility, and I told him, under no circumstances are you to access my records. And so I'm concerned that this bill doesn't even address for people who've had bad experiences with service providers and or police law enforcement officers to try and address some of those issues. And a lot of people have had some pretty bad experiences and how they've been treated and how they've been filled to be humiliated and degraded as individuals. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Becky.
I'm Megan Cahay, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify. I am impressed with Representative Holvey's caring and compassion and good intentions. My written testimony that I submitted addressed both bills, so I'll be brief. I feel that this bill separates persons with mental health issues out from other people, and that enforces the stigma of mental illness. I feel like this violates our human rights and hurts our ability to be self-determining and is an affront to our dignity, and that this is not useful for our recovery and our well-being. And I know that he means well, but this is not in our best interests. Thank you very much.
Questions of these ladies? Thank you so much for coming to testify. I think the last person I've got is Marie Farrell. Am I pronouncing that correctly, Marie? Farcell.
Problems with my handwriting.
I am also opposed to this bill. I understand there are problems with HIPAA because what it seems to do is allow everybody else to access information except your friends and family that you want to contact or to find someone. But, yeah, there's major problems with HIPAA. But this bill doesn't address those. It just allows people to access information back and forth without getting written permission. Now, as it stands now, if someone wants to access some information of any kind, they have to get your written permission. People sign permission for that all the time. If they're on any kind of government money, any kind of housing, anything, they have to sign permission to access information within a time frame for certain things. If people had a medical problem and they wanted someone to contact, it just seems to be aimed at people with mental problems rather than other kinds. But if they want, even someone with a mental problem, if they wanted one doctor to contact another, they could sign information. It would be sign their name and say, yes, you have permission to talk to this person. I think in a life-threatening emergency, like when the police are called or something, I can't imagine that they wouldn't be allowed to call mental health, or they wouldn't be allowed to call someone else. If they don't take the time to, that's no piece of paper is going to make them take the time to. But anything short of that, I think, should have to have my permission to share information. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's see if there are any questions. Marie? There might be a question. Any questions? Thank you so
Thank
much
you.
For coming to the
I'm smiling because we're considering a bill in another committee with a related issue. So. I won't go into details.
Okay.
My smile was related to the same
issue. That was helpful testimony. Thank you.
Yes.
Is there anyone else who is here to testify who hasn't signed up? One lady did sign up, and she chose not to speak. Yes, sir. I will need you to come up here. You know what I will do? I will close this hearing. Do you want to give us your written testimony? Or I can close this hearing and open up that one again. Sure. Okay, let me see if there are any other... Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Colleagues, it seems our work is cut out for us, as I said. But we will close the hearing on House Bill 2995 and reopen up the hearing on 3524.
My name is Chris Volk, and I've been involved in the mental health system for approximately 35 years. And my understanding of this bill is that it would create a database to help law enforcement address situations involving people who have been diagnosed with mental conditions in some manner. I believe that mental illness needs to be recognized in society as an important problem, as a primarily biochemical brain-based disorder that has complex causes, the nature of and extent of which should be addressed in an informed, comprehensive manner, not merely by a stopgap measure involving interface with law enforcement. Violent crime among those diagnosed with classic mental disorders and who are not abusing other substances is statistically no greater than that of the general population. So why single out those with recognized mental illnesses for special law enforcement consideration? Unwell or ill states of mind, including such things as bad attitudes, anger, rage, depression, prejudices, blank or low wave states of mind, misperceptions, repetitive dysfunctional behaviors, use of excessive control or unnecessary force over others, obsessions and addictions. I think we could all claim to having one or more of those, are all, in a sense, ill states of mind, even if only temporary. And mental illnesses themselves tend to come and go, like these states of mind. And many people take medication, yet avoid diagnosis, including some people in the healthcare system who recognize the effects of these medications, but understandably want to avoid the stigma associated with being diagnosed. And still others have undiagnosed mental conditions or physical conditions with mental ramifications. So using the official mental diagnosis of a relatively few individuals who may be more open and honest, even responsible about getting help for their problems, would be fairly arbitrary, discriminatory, and open to abuse, as is any other discriminatory policy or law. And I think this could set up an adversarial relationship with mental health consumers who want to be treated equally based on their actual social behavior, not some little understood criteria or a diagnosis of an inherently more powerful individual and authority, such as a psychiatrist. And psychiatrists themselves admit to not having a good understanding of the root causes and nature of an illness such as schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder, often stating that it is non-understandable. So how are their diagnoses logically, ethically, or legally applicable as a basis for special consideration by law enforcement? And I think this could lead to the unfortunate use of MAD profiling, or profiling those with diagnosed mental illnesses. Why not try to educate police in understanding and recognizing behavior that is problematic and dealing with people on an even-handed, objective basis according to what they are saying or doing at a particular time? General education and crisis intervention training is needed, but this sounds like a Band-Aid solution. Real understanding, education, and funding for programs addressing solutions to mental health issues are needed, but to spin off a bill like this and think that we are dealing with a problem would be unjustifiable. Why not? And in the same sense, why not set up a database of other groups that who have a more frequent interface with law enforcement, such as low-income people or people who have dropped out of high school, or for example, people from broken homes, or those with poor work performance, who are unemployed, or with any other sort of affiliation. The point is The point is that singling out mental illness as a factor for special treatment is inherently unfair, and we do need attention, education, research, and adequate funding for a more comprehensive and wiser solution to mental illness and health in our society. So I would oppose this particular measure, and thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you to stay right there and see if there are any questions. And I would really appreciate it if I know you've got written testimony here. If you would give it to Susan, she can make copies of it and give it to all of us so we can have it in our files. I really appreciate that. And if anybody else has written testimony, if they would leave it with us, that would be terrific. I know that you did, and that's great. Thank you so much for coming to testify. Thank you all, and thank you for our two representatives who offered these bills. And we have a huge task in front of us, and we are just seven people in the legislature, but I think probably most of the people in the legislature are as concerned as we are about these issues and trying to find some answers. Obviously, none of these answers are easy to find. We're going to work really hard on it, and we've heard testimony in other committees, and we're very concerned, and our hearts are there with you, and we especially appreciate the consumers who came and the families of consumers who came today, as well as the professionals. And Chris, it seems like we've heard this over and over again, doesn't it? And I've worked in this field a long time, and it feels like we're moving, but it's at a glacial speed. When we passed Senate Bill 1, we had hoped that would send us along the way, and it has, but we still have a long ways to go. So thank you for hanging in there. We're going to do the best that we can, and work with us. We'll see what we can come up with. With that, I will close the public hearing on, 3524. Any closing comments? Yes, Representative Gelser. Didn't you?
Looked down that way.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I just really appreciate you and everybody else here on our committee coming down here, and I appreciate everybody here from the Albany Port Alice area and everyone coming down from Portland, I know, and the Salem area for this. This has been very insightful. Appreciate that. Thank you.
And you've put a lot of work into this, and we really appreciate that work. So with that, I will close the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness. Again, thank you all very much.
No issue.